Coming up today, Apple hires the CEO of Burberry to run its retail operations. Plus, Asda is to launch a service in at least one of its stores that allows you to print a miniature version of yourself. And we'll discuss why freeze-drying the dead may actually be good for the future of the planet. Plus, we explore the challenges of running One Direction's biggest Twitter fan account by speaking to the girl who runs it. That's right, we're talking about One Direction. What next? Taylor Swift? All that and more coming up. Except Taylor Swift. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to dead body disposal and brain stimulation. I'm your host, Nate Legson, and I'm the amused, apparently, editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And later on, Nicholas, good old Nicholas, Nicholas, we like Nicholas. Should I keep saying his name?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he is going to come down and join us to talk about freeze-drying the dead, because he wrote a fab feature last week about such a topic. So, you know, look forward to that. But first, let's get on with the news. Liv, surprise move this week. Burberry CEO leaving Burberry soon to take over running Apple's stores.
Yep.
Fab dabby doozy.
She's leaving a very well-paid job. I think she's paid something like £17 million a year.
I think
she... Angela Arendt, we should say.
Yes, and I think she is the highest paid CEO in the country. I believe.
Possibly, very possibly. But yes, she's taking up this newly created role of Senior Vice President of Retail and Online Stores and will be reporting directly into Tim Cook as part of the executive team. And it's an interesting move, actually. Burberry, you know, you might consider it to be a heritage fashion brand, but it's actually one of the fashion brands that's embraced technology the most. It's got very futuristic flagship store with things like smart mirrors, and all the staff are aimed with iPads, and they'll do, you know, adjustments on the fly. And they've also made huge efforts in building massive social media audiences and created this really good unified experience between online and offline. And I think that's something that Apple could definitely benefit from.
Absolutely. Funnily enough, actually, at Fashion Week, one of the Fashion Weeks quite recently, they filmed the Burberry catwalk showcase with iPhone 5S's. So they rigged up a camera with iPhone, the new model iPhone,
yeah,
to film the whole thing in like that super slow motion that they did, which is quite neat.
So definitely happy bedfellows. And it's interesting for Apple generally, because they've made a few recruitments?
Yeah.
Hires like this recently. They hired a guy called Paul Deneuve from Yves Saint Laurent earlier this year, and also Nike's design director Paul Schaffer, who's been involved in the Nike Plus Fitbit type fuel band thing. Yeah.
So several fashion brands, basically.
So what could this possibly mean?
Well, I think that it's easy to apply logic and think that this means wearables, and that might be a factor. But actually, it's because I think fashion brands, particularly high-end fashion brands, have to do quite a lot to make something very expensive and, you know, compared to the competition, seemingly extortionate, perhaps,
yeah,
attractive to the average person in the street. And Apple, say what you want about them, their products are expensive. They're good, but they're also very expensive when you compare them to the competition. And
yeah,
when you look at, you know, a £1,500, £2,000 Burberry long coat or whatever, versus a competing one that probably looks similar but costs a tenth as much, I think there's some logic.
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely, yeah. How have you convinced people to think yours is the norm?
Yeah.
Which Apple's already done.
Having recently gone in and tried to buy a MacBook Air from the Apple Store, I can attest to the fact that their online and retail experiences are not unified in the way that they should be. I couldn't order the slightly tweaked version of the MacBook Air that I wanted in store. I had to go online, and that seemed pretty ludicrous to me, and it's something that I think Apple does need to work on.
Well, we'll see if that change happens. We'll also see perhaps if the Apple Store staff stop wearing just t-shirts and start wearing Burberry kit.
Highly unlikely.
Liat, as I once again turn my balls of eye towards you.
Hi there.
I have to ask you about the Future Generations report. Now, apparently, we need global shared values to secure our future.
Yeah, no biggie.
No big deal, this.
This is being proposed by the Oxford Martin Future Generations Commission, which is an astonishing number of kind of world-leading thinkers in economics, science, business, like anything you can think of. Ariana Huffington is in on it, along with people from NGOs and all sorts. Anyway, so this report is really ambitious in its scope. It basically is looking at what are the most serious global world issues now, how can we tackle them? And a lot of the things they come up with are things we already know, you know, that more people are moving into cities, you know, we have an aging population, youth unemployment, things like that. But they do put forward 15 proposals for solutions for tackling these, which I think is fairly optimistic. I went to a roundtable this morning with some of the people who wrote the report, and they are very much believers that this is practical stuff. We can do it, guys. But a lot of it hinges on, you know, global leaders agreeing with each other. You know,
well, that in itself is a major global challenge, because
yeah.
we have several thousand years of global leaders not agreeing
saying,
with each other.
Yeah, we do the opposite quite naturally.
Well, what's a couple of examples? So what are some things that they've said, this is a problem, this is how we're going to solve it?
Okay, a couple good ones to pick out. So CyberX, a platform that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of an early warning system for cyber threats. But they want businesses, private and public corporations and governments to all kind of sign up to this and, you know, open up their data for this platform to monitor for unusual web traffic or whatever.
This is like getting governments to say all banks have to have some sort of code, let's say on a simplistic level, some sort of code in their website or something that can be monitored centrally.
Yeah, we can collate all this data.
And collate it all.
And on top of that, globally as well, kind of, you know, agreeing between governments to share this information.
Admirable sentiments, yeah. Probably absolutely impossible.
I didn't get a chance to say this because we only got one question this morning, but you know, impractical on a lot of levels. They think it is very reasonable, minimal infrastructure, you know, a lot of it done in the cloud and things like this, not very expensive, but just in terms of, you know, I mean, privacy issues, all sorts, there's a lot of problems that would need to be overcome before anyone would agree to something like this.
That's a list that writes itself. What's another suggestion then? Is this one more feasible?
Well, again, transparent taxation. Basically, tackling a problem we have seen in the last couple of years with people like Google and Facebook, Starbucks, shifting profits to tax havens. How do we tackle this? Okay, let's convince corporations to volunteer up their, you know, their numbers, their profits, their tax, what they do, what loopholes they use, you know, volunteer up all this information publicly or privately, you know, to a platform that will assess it, and also convince governments to say what kind of tax regimes they prefer. And this is all with the mind to have a fairer system, everyone paying their equal, you know, fair share in every country. But again, that relies on, you know, all countries agreeing, all companies agreeing. Otherwise, some very, you know, savvy company is going to make a massive profit when they don't.
That seems to me like it's slightly more feasible, given that international trade being what it is, it makes sense to have a mutual arrangement where you're not screwing each other out of tax.
No, absolutely, that makes sense.
It makes sense for those who aren't doing so well, I guess.
Yeah, but if it's voluntary, how are you going to get people to do this? You know, they were saying it's going to be reputation. And we've seen it already with, you know, Google saying, you know, we want to pay, tell us what to pay, you know, let's talk about this. It's not like they're closed off to it, but of course they can afford, you know, to be open and say this.
We need kind of like a G8 for, you know, the rich list.
Yeah.
CEO, C-level.
There probably is, but we just don't know about
it. There probably is. Well, you were pointing out this morning, Liv, that Ireland has said that they're going to close the Irish loophole, which is exploited by, apparently legally, by the likes of Apple and Google and Facebook. And it means that they pay only a few million in tax a year, despite doing revenue in the billions.
Yeah, they'll funnel a lot of the revenue from the UK. They'll do the final deal in an Irish office. So that means that the money is technically going through Ireland, which means that they have to pay the tax rate, the corporate tax rate in Ireland, as opposed to in the UK, which
much higher. Yeah. Fascinating. You've got a write-up on the website that I think one of the people involved in this project called you out on in our roundtable this morning.
It was a little awkward. He eyed me.
What did you say?
Well, he said in response to something, I do not see this as an optimistic utopia.
And that's what you described in your story
Yeah, it doesn't mean I don't want it and I don't agree with it and it doesn't all make sense and we should all be doing it. It's whether or not anyone will or can.
Asda doing something a bit interesting, something that I saw sort of, or heard about at least, happening in Harajuku in Tokyo last year. From the 15th of October, which is already passed probably by the time you're listening to this, Asda is going to be trialling a new 3D printing service at one of its stores in York. The idea being that customers can take a bit of a break from trolley wielding during weekly shops and print a tiny ceramic version of themselves and their families and even their cats.
Well, they have to take their cats.
You can take your cat into the supermarket.
Oh, yes. Well, it's theoretical.
You can in York.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit silly, but the reason I like this idea is that it's clearly the result of, you know, supermarket heads in a boardroom starting to think more about 3D printing, whether there's an interest from consumers. You know, a company like Asda, which, you know, for any of our American listeners, is basically the Walmart of the UK. And funnily, actually,
it's owned by Walmart,
yeah. Isn't it? You know, if they start investing in this sort of thing, then, basically what I'm saying is they've got to start somewhere. Yeah. And this is gauging interest, I think, which is quite fun.
It introduces the technology to a lot of people who may not have ever encountered it. I mean, we write about 3D printing the whole time, but we forget that most people, this is not something you come across in your daily routine.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's why I wonder if anyone will pay. I mean, it's £40 starting price.
It's 40 quid. And no, I mean, I sort of imagine my mum walking around Asda. Is she likely to see the booth and think, oh, I better come back with the cat? I mean, I hope she does. But no, you're absolutely right. But it's one of those things where I think you might walk through and you see it and you sort of take note and then you go home, but then you tell the kids when you get home, or you tell your partner, and then you think, well, why don't we do that on Saturday? Why don't we all go and get 3D printed? So it's 40 quid, and that's going to be happening from nowish. So if you're in York, go do it. Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. We're very curious. The other thing I wanted to mention as part of this segment, which is mainstream retailer news, according to my little subheading in my show notes here, is that Argos has followed Tesco in launching a super low-budget tablet. It's called the My Tablet. It's a 7-inch device that goes on sale for 99 quid this week. And, it's a bit of an unoriginal name, but it's another Android based tablet that actually undercuts the sort of £120-ish Tesco Huddle that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So it's got a basic screen, it's got an entry-level processor, a small amount of storage and memory, but it runs Android. And for 99 quid, you know, as long as performance is acceptable, that's pretty much a bargain. I mean, we've seen a lot of low-cost tablets, but even when we talk about low-cost, we talk about them being about sort of 170, 180, maybe £200. Mm. And we talk about low-cost basically in relation to, you know, Apple and maybe some of the Samsung devices. So 99 quid comes in pink, comes in silver, very much, I think, aimed at kids.
But then pitted against the Tesco's tablet, what do you think? Because it doesn't quite have the same ecosystem.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, Tesco, we talked about this in a previous show, that the Huddle will probably succeed or fail based on how well Tesco's own services are integrated into it with offers and things like that. And Argos definitely doesn't have the same, you know, they don't have their own movie download store. They don't have a grocery service. They don't have those sorts of things. Yeah. The Huddle could become very good at making customers use, like the Kindle does for Amazon stuff. But I think it's priced at a good point. I mean, we're coming up to Christmas, £99. Kind of a bit like the basic Kindle. It feels like a really generous, expensive present if you give someone a Kindle.
Yeah.
But actually, they're not that expensive for a lot of people buying a big present for somebody, I think.
Are we saying this is throwaway tablet? Disposable.
Not throwaway.
100 quid?
Not throwaway.
What planet are you living on?
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not. It's still a lot of money.
I'm saying
you would rather surely go with something that's offering, if you're spending that amount of money, that something that's offering a bit more.
You say that, but it's twice as much to go for something like the, you know, the Google Nexus 7, which is, you know, way, way, way high powered, way more capable, but costs twice as much, even though that's a cheap tablet.
I guess when you think about it, my nieces and nephews are very young and they use iPads like constantly, like I used to play with dolls. Like,
but iPads are expensive.
And that's what I mean. Like, they have my brother has like a bulky case around it, but this is probably much more suitable to give them.
I think so. Well, let us know what you think, and if you fancy picking one up, or if you have picked one up, you know, would you buy a £99 tablet? We're really genuinely very, very curious because none of us are parents. So let us know. Last story in the first half of the show, this. Liat, brain stimulation. I'm just going to leave it there. Yeah. Whose brains have you been stimulating?
That, well, everyone's. No. A group at the University of Chicago has been stimulating macaque brains.
Macaque.
These cute little monkeys that have been probed in their cortex that controls sensory functions.
Okay, let's cut to the news then. This stimulation has basically allowed these monkeys to feel, quote unquote, feel when a prosthetic hand has been touched.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is obviously so that we can get much better prostheses for us, you know, not for the macaque population. So they have found out that stimulating the right neural pathways will replicate the sensation of touch. And so they did a number of experiments. One involved training them to look one way when their index finger was touched and the other if their fourth finger was touched. Then they implanted the electrode array in the primary somatosensory cortex and recorded the neural pathways that were stimulated when, you know, which specific finger was being touched. So they mapped this out and recorded everything to micrometer precision so that they could see exactly which area of the skin touched led to the specific patterns being made. When the electrodes were reversed and did the stimulating rather than the recording, the monkeys looked in the correct direction according to whether the neural pattern was for the index finger or the fourth finger. We can replicate it. This wasn't the one done with the prostheses, but they did follow up with one which was measuring pressure. And they used a prosthetic arm and hand with pressure sensors. And when the hand was touched in a specific place, an algorithm in the limb's microcomputer would calculate the pressure exerted and translate this to the appropriate electrical stimulation.
Now, I have a question to ask.
Yes.
How do you apply an amputated arm to a monkey? Did they have to lop off arms?
No, they just they did not lop off any arms. They just connected, you know, some wires. We've done that actually already. Well, not we personally, but a university in Lausanne has done a similar thing whereby the patient's nerves are connected through external wires that then connect to the prostheses.
Actually, we talked about those in our Transhumanism Week with series of features. Well, we had an email that has come in just as we've been recording the show from a concerned fan.
Yeah, it's a guy called Ed Hook who's concerned that they did actually amputate the monkey's arms. He says, "I don't know the source of that photo at the top of the page, but that animal looks sad and broken when you look at its eyes."
Shutterstock. That wasn't an animal that was...
He said, "I think if my arms were loosely tied, I would do what I think is expected of me, just in the vain hope that I'd get out of this miserable situation. I'm surprised that you've published this story, Wired. This research doesn't fill me with any kind of hope at all. Next week, you'll be publishing a story on how much like humans monkeys are, or a story about the poor amputee veterans. Maybe you could get your hands amputated and run a story about how wonderful it is."
Well, I'm not entirely sure these hands were amputated, Rita. I will look into this. But the bit he's referring to, loosely tied, is that they train the monkeys to hold their hands palm up and then they just prod their fingers. They had some loose ties around their arms to encourage them to keep their arms in that place.
I think a slight disconnect there between someone looking at the photograph of a monkey that we have on the website and thinking that sad-looking monkey was the one having his arms lopped off.
Mm. I mean, more than anything, they have an electrode array in their brain. You know, that was what made me uncomfortable when I was reading it.
Yeah.
I don't think their arms are amputated.
Plus, monkeys are a bit like humans.
Yeah.
And bonobos, you know, I think we're like 97 or so, a bit percent genetically identical to a bonobo. And more so, I think possibly closer to a bonobo. What is it? Are we closer to a...
Chimpanzees.
Yeah. Macaques were chosen specifically because I think our neural pathways are quite similar.
Oh, is that right?
Our nervous system. But yeah, I mean, I think we will move on to humans pretty quickly. They're already doing it at this university in Lausanne. They are actually going to attach a prosthesis which uses nerves in the arm that control the hand to replicate sensory function.
Well, there was that chap. There was that chap we talked about a few weeks ago. The he was a chef, I think, and there was the crowdfunded.
The Open Hand project.
Open Hand, that was it. Yeah,
and that was a kind of budget prosthetic robotic hand that has been developed by a guy in Bristol.
Yeah,
which is fascinating, and it uses all these 3D printed components to, but with the same electrodes to allow people to control an arm for people who wouldn't normally be able to afford one of these prosthetic robotic arms, which can cost tens of thousands of pounds.
Mm. Yeah, that was amazing, because I think that one of the guys who'd signed up under the trial had already, he was a chef and he'd already been able to start peeling potatoes again.
Yeah, it's incredible when you watch the dexterity that people already have with the robotic prosthesis. And the whole point of this is, just to make it much more natural and much more dexterous, because if you think about it, like grasping an object, you have to be watching all the time your prosthesis to make sure you're doing the right thing. But if you can feel that something's slipping from your grasp, you'll grab it. All the things you take for granted.
Yeah. Well, that was a wildly unplanned and comprehensive summary of prosthetics and technology.
I really hope no macaques had their arms amputated.
No, I'm sure. It's totally armless. Okay, it's time to get ourselves into an ad break. When we come back, though, we're going to hear about how freeze-drying the dead could help save the planet, as told with the help of Nicholas, who'll be joining us. And also, we're going to hear about all the challenges of running the biggest One Direction Twitter fan account in the world. It's time to get a free audiobook. It's that thing we do every week that lots of you seem to like to enjoy. So we're going to remind you to do that. If you go to audible.co.uk/wired, you will notice that Audible is still offering you a free book from a catalogue of over 80,000 for being a wired.co.uk podcast listener. You get a 1 month free trial that costs no pounds and no pence to sign up. Choose a book. Download the book. It costs you nothing. Listen to it, enjoy it. You'll be supporting our show, and you get to try out Audible's service as well. So head now to audible.co.uk/wired, and we thank them and you for your support. Welcome back. First segment of the second half. Thank you, science. It's time to talk about death.
Yes.
And Nicholas Tufnell is here to talk about death.
I am.
Freeze-drying the dead.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting woman from Sweden. She's called Suzanne Wigmasak. I may have got her name wrong there. That's certainly how it's spelled. I don't know how to pronounce it, so apologies. So she's created something called Promessa or Promession, where essentially you get the body, the corpse, you freeze it initially to -18 degrees, then you put it in a vat of liquid nitrogen, then that is sort of vibrated, or there's extreme vibration, so that it breaks down into millions or thousands of pieces, millimeter pieces of dust, and then that sort of keeps its organic form, which is very important because that's good for the soil when it comes to burying it, which is buried in sort of a very shallow grave, and a plant or a bush is then placed on top of that.
Now, is this something we need? I've never really considered the need for more, I don't know, not ethical disposals of corpses, but certainly more ecologically friendly. Is this a challenge?
Well, reading this feature, you discover that actually there are some environmental concerns with our regular process of either burying or cremation, right, Nicholas?
Yeah, there are quite a number, which I really wasn't aware of, and I'm not a particularly green-minded sort of guy, so I wasn't aware of a lot of the stuff that I uncovered. Basically, cremation, there's a lot of fossil fuels going on there. To cremate a body, you really need to burn it at 800 degrees Celsius for 90 minutes minimum. But if you really want to fully cremate it, it needs to be done for about 5 hours. If it's not, you're left with bones that then need to be raked out and crushed. So you kind of get this weird half cremation, half crushing process.
Is this anything remotely similar to how you can technically microwave a chicken, but it's better to do it in an oven?
Kind of, yeah. Right. Yeah. So we have these ways that technically work, but if Promessa does work, And there are a lot of people that are actually suggesting there are lots of reasons why it won't work. If it does work, though, it's so much better than cremation because it's more ecologically friendly, and it's a process that isn't particularly expensive or particularly hard to do.
That's true. Liquid nitrogen's dirt cheap, isn't it?
Incredibly cheap. I had no idea. It's less. A pint of liquid nitrogen is less than a pint of milk.
Wow.
which is really cheap. But the problem was that, or the problem with this process is, if you want to make liquid nitrogen, that apparently, according to the cremation industry in Sweden, that is actually very difficult to do and requires a lot of energy, about as much energy as it takes to burn a body for 90 minutes. So.
The other thing that was mentioned in the piece, which I thought was interesting, was this idea of things like mercury fillings and the exposure that the workers in the crematorium have to these dangerous substances.
Yeah, so again, this is all from Suzanne, so... she would say this because she doesn't want the cremation industry to do particularly well. But what she said was that burning a lot of bodies can release a lot of mercury. And of course, mercury can make you go a bit mad. It can poison you. It's very bad for you. And the people that were working at the cremation industries, once they died, they had done these sort of autopsies in the UK, because in Sweden they wouldn't allow it, on the bodies, and they found that there was a large amount of mercury in the brains of the people that had been working in crematoriums.
So, what are the main challenges for something like this? I mean, aside from the vast quantities of liquid nitrogen needed.
The main challenges really are convincing people this is better than what we already have, because, as you say, it works and it has been working for a long time. And as you say, getting the cost of, or rather the energy required to make liquid nitrogen, to be significantly reduced.
Isn't there also the sort of idea that because the body isn't changed, although it's frozen and it's divided into small pieces, it's still the human flesh, it's not burnt to ash. So the idea that you'll be scattering this material that then, you know, might be eaten by things, although the body does decompose and it gets absorbed by plants, it kind of feels more immediate, the idea that this body has just been shattered and
absolutely
distributed.
And convincing people to be put in a shallow grave as well is going to be difficult, and the reason for doing that is it's better for the soil. But you're right. The body is still in its organic form. It contains a lot of carbon when it has been dried. When you have a freeze-dried body, so if a bird comes along and eats that particular part of the soil, or if you throw it in the sea like you would with ashes, a fish could eat it, and then you could eat the fish, or you could eat the bird, and then it's kind of like you're eating people.
It's cannibalism by proxy.
Exactly. And a lot of people are going to be uncomfortable with that.
Isn't everything cannibalism by proxy? It's just how many times removed it is.
Exactly. But, you know,
so the grass grows, the cows eat it, you eat the cows.
Are you saying when I found out that some of my burgers had horse in it, I might have also eaten an old friend?
Yeah.
Wow, it was delicious. He was delish. It's a fascinating feature. One point I wanted to call out on here is that apparently the process doesn't always work that well, and bones frequently need to be raked out of the machines and crushed.
That's cremation. That's what can happen in cremation.
Oh, yeah. I do beg your pardon. It's down in my notes. Well, that's good. That's not a problem.
So that problem will be removed entirely. No longer will we have to worry about crushing our loved ones' bones, because the process within cremation is just not adequate enough at the moment.
Have you ever seen one of those little science demos where someone shoves a rose into a vat of liquid nitrogen and then they tap it lightly with a hammer and it shatters to pieces?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I imagine this whole process to be like. I mean, they say intense vibrations. What they actually mean is whacking it with a tuning fork or something like that.
Pretty much. I mean,
I wondered though whether you could do a sort of slightly reduced version of this, because hospitals have these sorts of crematoriums in their basements for getting rid of, you know, I mean, it's a bit nasty, but tumors and things that are removed from bodies and body parts and amputations and things. And I do wonder whether this is something that on a smaller scale perhaps could be applied to this.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
You know, because it would be easier to implement, and it would certainly, you know, seems like it would be beneficial long term.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think as with all these really interesting and innovative ideas, even if the idea itself doesn't work, there's probably a hell of a lot of good science in that that you can then use and apply to other areas and that can be just effective elsewhere. So even if this doesn't work, and I hope it does, and I hope that it's something that we can use soon, and there certainly have been some UK politicians that are saying, look, this is the way to go.
literally.
Yeah, quite literally. However, I think I really need to make clear that I did contact some of the crematoria in Sweden, and they did say, this is nonsense. She's kept dead bodies frozen for 10 years. She's, you know, she doesn't doesn't know what she's talking about and it doesn't work. However, then Suzanne said, they are going to say this. They're trying to ruin me. They're all in it together. I'm going to ruin their business if I become popular. Yeah. And it was just this, it ended up being this really strange turf war between these two different body disposal units. And it makes for a really interesting feature that you should check out.
To be fair, they said that about Galileo, yeah. You know, and Ptolemy.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Anyway, that slight aside then.
Ptolemy the cat.
Ptolemy was Ptolemy was
whose cat
Patrick,
was it?
So Patrick Moore's cat. Yeah, who I stroked once.
But you weren't referring to him.
No, I was referring to the
original.
The original Ptolemy, yeah, the namesake. Okay, Nicholas's feature is on the website. If you search for freeze-drying the dead, I'm pretty sure you'll just find this one story. Yeah. Well worth a read. Quite a long feature, actually. Even for us, it's quite a lengthy piece of work.
Yeah, it's pretty meaty.
Fantastic read. I suggest reading it on a tube to Ealing Broadway. I can attest that that's a great place to read it. Nicholas, thank you.
Thank you.
Second section for the second half of this programme is, we haven't heard from this one for a little while, WWWTF. Now, I put this one under WWWTF because One Direction, and by extension, I suppose, some of these types of pop groups, when it comes to online, they really are a bit of an enigma. Yeah. And the way that their fans are now using social media, the internet, mobile technologies to effectively stalk these men and women is absolutely fascinating. And so, Liv, this week you wrote a piece that I was hugely excited about when you told me you were working on it, that we've called 16 and Hacked, The Challenges of Running One Direction's Biggest Twitter Fan Account.
Yeah. So I spoke to this 16-year-old girl called SJ, who runs the largest individual One Direction fan account. So she has 870,000 followers, which she's accumulated in just 3 years. So just to give you a sense about that means, that's bigger than Boris Johnson's following, Topshop, MTV UK and Richard Dawkins. So it's a pretty large audience. And I just wanted to know what it's like to be, you know, we hear a lot of stories about either aggression on social media or kind of challenges for young people online. I want to see what it's like to be have that sort of account.
Plus, we know from experience that One Direction's fan, a number of them are absolutely bonkers. They are bat waste crazy.
Yeah, and I'll come to that in a little bit. So the first thing that's really interesting about having this account is that she has a lot of attempts from people trying to hack her account. Obviously, if you've got a huge following, people want to take control of that following and use it to tweet out spam links or what have you. And in one case, it was actually quite sophisticated. She got contacted by someone proclaiming to be a representative of One Direction's management, and it had a spoofed email address with the right sort of domain by the looks of it. And they said they kind of lured her in with all these promises of VIP access to the boys and tickets. And she kind of started to suspect things when they said, oh, you must reply on this Hotmail account. And it all seemed a bit fishy. And then it turned out that the people, you know, the name of the person they claimed to be didn't exist. And it's just this idea of social engineering to try and take control of a 16-year-old girl's account on Twitter seems pretty ludicrous. The second interesting thing that she talked about was the idea of how One Direction fans can get a topic trending on Twitter. Now, that occasionally happens for us and we're kind of very excited about it. But for her, this is something that they can do on a daily basis. I asked her, when was the last time that One Direction fans got something trending? And she said, oh, this morning, I just tweeted something out and asked people to share it. And we got it trending. I was like, oh, right, is that London or UK? She said, worldwide.
I hope she's using her powers for good.
And well, this is the thing. I mean, trending topics for it's something that we in the industry see all the time. And sometimes you see, you know, people see it on TV, they include a hashtag. But sort of within the industry, getting a topic trending on Twitter is a top line requirement for a lot of media campaigns. We get it from a lot from PRs who, you know, please tweet this and cover this and at their launch events, tweet this, because they it's seen as such insane publicity that people will pay huge amounts of money for.
Yeah.
And this girl can do this in a matter of minutes almost.
Yeah. And that's a fascinating thing. I mean, this band, One Direction, have this hugely engaged Twitter following and they're doing all this promotional work for them. And I guess her concern was that she wasn't getting any kind of reciprocation from One Direction. You know, they'd got them to where they were, and that perhaps, you know, maybe there could be a better way of engaging with the fans on a day-to-day basis through Twitter. And she was kind of a little bit upset about that. But on the ingression front, I think the thing you're referring to was this GQ cover stories we had of the One Direction boys.
Yes.
And for some reason, a lot of One Direction fans took a disliking to the cover lines that had been selected to go on the covers of the magazines. They didn't feel they were representative of the boys they knew and loved.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, GQ is one of our other publications, and this got to the extent of bomb threats.
Death threats. Bleach in the eye threats.
Yeah, I mean,
very
seriously.
Very creative ways to murder editors.
If you've ever seen any of the worst types of YouTube comments on videos, that's what editors were getting for this.
Yeah, so I asked SJ about this, and first of all, she was very kind of diplomatic about it, and she pointed out that, you know, there are a huge number of One Direction fans, and this is just a small subsection. And to be fair, One Direction is the most popular pop band on the planet, I think, at the moment. But she said that, you know, just because there's a bully in a classroom doesn't mean that the whole class is a bully, which I agree. However, she did have some ideas about how GQ could run its business a little bit better, and had suggestions that they should have a panel of One Direction fans for the next time they choose to feature them on the cover, who they can consult about which cover lines to use, which I thought was a lovely idea, but I think it shows a slight misunderstanding of how the publishing industry works.
Yes, on the other hand, for a girl who can single-handedly get a topic trending worldwide, that's quite a bit of sort of potential business acumen there.
Yeah, exactly.
On her part. So maybe some meeting in the middle somewhere could work. It's a fascinating, absolutely fascinating topic. Really, really is. I really enjoyed reading this. It's a great read. And that is findable, if you like, by searching One Direction.
Yeah.
On Wired.co.uk.
I just add that I didn't mention her Twitter account is at Stylator Army, STYLATOR Army, just in case you're interested.
Has she tweeted our story?
I don't think she has.
Can she get us trending, please, our podcast?
I'll ask her.
SJ, seriously, do it now. Cheers. Best wishes, Nate. Liv, we had some feedback from the jellyfish story last week.
Yes, we did. We had some feedback from Diogo Trigo, who just said, "This is the best idea in the history of mankind."
Yeah, referring to the idea of slicing up jellyfish in order to, well, what was it they were doing?
To dispose of them, because they clog up power stations and boat, not ventilation systems, but whatever the equivalent is for
a
boat. I think there have been a few other ideas that might be better than jellyfish slicing.
Just do what I do with my brother. My brother's terrified of spiders, you know, which is shame. And I offered to just put the Dyson vac on it.
No, because they can crawl out from the little bowels of the vacuum cleaner and they'll come and get you again.
No, not if you keep spinning around on the floor until it's been churned up.
But also, this is what people who aren't scared of spiders don't understand. Like, hoovering up the spider requires you to be within about 2 meters of distance from the spider.
That's a long way.
That is not a long way.
No, we have a very long extension, and when you find it, you're close. So when you are far apart with your hoover, you feel very far.
But you're also handing it a straw that it can clutch upon, climb up, and get onto your arm. And
have you felt how powerful that Dyson sucks?
Yeah. I don't do the hoovering either. I get the non-scared of spider person to hoover it.
Well, how do you kill insects? Podcast at wired.co.uk. We've also got some feedback. We asked this on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wiredUK. Now, Apple has another event coming up next week on Tuesday evening, which I will be attending. And we are strongly expecting it to be iPads, Macs, OS X related stuff. Possibly some talk about iTunes Radio coming to the UK, but we'll see. So we asked on Facebook what people are looking forward to seeing, or at least hoping to see. And a couple I'm going to pick out here. Matt Greenfield writes in, "I think it's more or less a given that there will be a new iPad with the same fingerprint scanner as the new iPhone. I suspect that a Retina display iPad mini will be announced with the same coloured backs as the iPhone 5C. I'm sceptical, though," he adds, "that we'll see an iWatch right now, if at all." I completely agree with everything Matt has written. The iPad mini coloured backs, yes, an interesting one. Not seen any case leaks yet. So one of the things we'll keep our eye on are leaks of photographs coming from Chinese manufacturers that actually build these parts, because they often get sort of cases a bit early. And that's usually a good indicator of Apple's direction. We've seen case leaks for iPad mini, but we've not seen any coloured ones. So that will be an interesting one. Paul Mellish writes in, regular Paul Mellish.
Yeah.
Hello, Paul. Retina display iPad mini seems assert. Coloured backs also highly likely. Wearable tech? I think the jury is still out on how to best to implement that. Looking at the invite, maybe iLeaf will be the new thing, a device that triggers your Apple products in the home, a la geofencing for Apple TV. Referring to the fact that the invite has what it looks like, a colourful bird's tail being whacked with a Dyson sucking force.
Okay.
Yeah. For the benefit of the listeners, I had a good description on a podcast the other day at the weekend. It looks like the NBC feather logo being...
The peacock
being
messed
being
up.
Blown.
Feathers yeah. everywhere.
Well, that's going to do it for the show this week. If you want to get in touch, and you should, podcast@wired.co.uk on the Facebook, facebook.com/wiredUK, or of course on Twitter, twitter.com/wiredUK. We really do want to encourage more feedback because we love hearing from you guys. And sometimes we get it, but we don't always read it out. But we like the slightly longer ones with a nice explanation of your opinion. So do keep those coming in, podcast@wired.co.uk. And also thanks to Macworld for putting our podcast at number one in a recent episode, column, article about the best tech podcasts in the world.
Yeah,
take that, Ted. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.